Welcome to Inside the Hut. I'm your host, Brooke Pollock, founder of Hut Capital. Inside the Hut is a podcast that talks with leading blockchain venture capital investors to dive deep into their firm, strategy, and approach to a complex space at the forefront of innovation. You can find this and other episodes on Spotify and other podcast players, or on our website at www.hutcapital.com. The content of each episode of Inside the Hut is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as legal, business, tax, or investment advice, or be used to evaluate any investment or security and is not directed at any investors or potential investors in any Hut Capital fund. Please note that Hut Capital and its affiliates may also maintain or be considering investments in or related to the companies, funds, assets, or strategies discussed in the podcast. For more details, including a link to our investments and related disclosures, please see www.hutcapital.com. Welcome, everyone, to this week's episode of Inside the Hut with your host, Brooke Pollock. We're really excited to have with us this week, Ben Forman, founder of Parify Capital. I remember meeting with you, Ben, back, must have been late 2018, maybe. We were both kind of starting our firms at the time. And yeah, it's been really fun to see all the progress and success you guys have had at Parify. So really excited for the conversation and to catch folks up on what you've been up to in recent years. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, likewise. Really humbled to be here. And yeah, I remember the WeWork in San Francisco. I think it was late 2018 when Bitcoin was around 3K in the 2018 bear market. So now it's 6 years later, and it's exciting that we're both still in the space.
Yeah, absolutely. What was your name back then? You guys had a different name in it originally. I can't recall what it was, though.
Yeah, our initial name was Blocktree Capital, and another firm poached that domain and was kind of posing as us in the market. So we rebranded very quickly to Parify, which is short for Paradigm Shift in Finance. And we never looked back, but good memory.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to lie. I think it was for the best. So maybe worked out for a reason. Yeah, for some reason, I was thinking Parify was, I don't know, some sort of like Latin thing, but maybe just misremembering that. So anyways, just to introduce yourself, maybe you can give some background on yourself, your kind of history, and what you were doing prior to Parify.
Yeah, so I grew up in Seattle, Washington. I went to college kind of with the expectation of going into academia. I wanted to get a PhD in economics. So I took a lot of kind of behavioral economics, game theory courses. And I was at Penn undergrad, and Penn sends large swaths of people to Wall Street each year. And I actually didn't have much context when I entered Penn about Wall Street or the buy side or the sell side or how capital markets really worked. But I thought it was a great venue for learning. So I kind of just went on that path. So I spent the first 10 years of my career from 2008 to 2018 working across different finance roles. So everything from investment banking to private equity to credit investing. Most recently, before launching Parify, I was at KKR, focused on the credit side of the platform. I initially kind of intersected with Bitcoin back in 2015. Actually, like there was a distinct evening when I was living in San Francisco. My apartment in Russian Hill, one of my roommates at the time worked at Google. He was an engineer there, and he had a dinner party at our place. And I was chatting with some of the people that were there about Bitcoin, and I had never heard of it, but it kind of captured my attention because I thought it was an interesting idea. And I think the thing that kind of galvanized my interest originally was just that there was this kind of cryptographic scarcity to it. There could only be 21 million ever created, which I think is a property that is rare to see in an asset class. And then I, from there, kind of kept on going deeper into the ecosystem. I spent a lot of time on the Bitcoin subreddit, which is really where all the discussion took place in Bitcoin. Now it's much more noise than signal, but I would go to meetups in the Mission, talk to Bitcoin miners, go have lunch at the Coinbase cafeteria when it was a Series A or B company, and just kind of try to learn about the space. In summer of 2015, I grabbed an intern at KKR. And we put together a detailed write-up on the broader crypto space, mostly Bitcoin at the time. Bitcoin was like a $3, $4 billion asset, and there were maybe a handful of other tokens that were remotely relevant. And so the goal of this project was really to pitch KKR as a firm on what was going on in the blockchain ecosystem, because we thought, one, it could be an investable opportunity, and two, the technology could disrupt some of their portfolio companies. Actually, at the time, the largest portfolio company across all of KKR was First Data, now called Fiserv, but the largest kind of payment processing business. And back in 2015, 2016, the big narrative around blockchain was that Bitcoin was going to disrupt legacy payment rails and disintermediate the interchange, merchant acquirers, kind of that whole supply chain. Of course, like looking in hindsight, that hasn't happened yet and probably won't for Bitcoin because we now have stable coins, but it seemed like a risk. So anyway, went through this whole exercise at KKR, and there really wasn't interest at the time at the firm level to pursue this. It was just too early. But I kind of stayed close to the space. It became just a passion of mine. And what was really, I would say, my 0-1 moment was in 2016, early 2017, I came across the MakerDAO white paper. And I was a credit investor by background. So I intimately understood kind of debt capital markets. And MakerDAO was this decentralized revolving credit facility that used smart contracts and code to execute kind of credit-like logic. And I found it to be just really fascinating, kind of elegant, simple, in some ways like less risky than human underwriting. And towards the end of 2017, early 2018, I made the decision to leave KKR to start a firm in the space. And there was some discussion at KKR like, hey, maybe I should pursue this internally out of existing pools of capital. But there really wasn't a great fit because at that point in time, the opportunity set was more on the liquid token side. There weren't many post-product market fit, like growth stage companies in the space, which would align more with KKR's pool of capital. So I took the leap and started Parify, and here we are.
Awesome. Yeah, really appreciate the background. So what was the initial vision for what you wanted to build with Parify? And then maybe you can kind of give a quick overview of what the firm and the team looks like today.
Yeah, I'd love to be able to tell you that I had this like perfect, clear vision around what I wanted Parify to be when I started it. But the reality is that the journey has been very nonlinear. There have been lots of fits and starts. The term DeFi didn't even exist when I started Parify. The kind of core focus that I had coming into this was really to kind of have an open, curious mind and look kind of broadly across the ecosystem. I had a sense that blockchain technology could like disintermediate legacy incumbent financial services businesses, but I didn't really know exactly how that was going to happen. The focus from the beginning was really on products that bridged financial services and blockchains. So these are really innovations in capital markets, front ends that make blockchains easier to use for institutions, tokenization of asset, real world assets, which has really been a theme now for 7 or 8 years. And I think Parify, where we kind of stumbled upon was what we called crypto finance in the early days, kind of early 2019, late 2018. It's now obviously called DeFi. And we were really early in that category, a seed investor in Lido, and we were users of Uniswap V1, AMMs, and kind of really digging deep into these early financial products on chain, and just spend a lot of time getting really deep in the technical nuances and the economic edge cases and how the oracles worked and how these bonding curves were structured. And through using these products in DeFi, for me, that's really where the light bulb went off in terms of saying, hey, this is like a pretty exciting investable opportunity. And that's really been our focus ever since. And the term DeFi, I think, has evolved quite a bit, but really it's on investing in products that in the blockchain space that are going to disrupt or enhance the financial services sector. And that's really where we've been focused ever since.
Awesome. Yeah, I remember, yeah, back in the day, you guys were kind of one of the first firms to really get heavy in the DeFi space. Yeah, back before DeFi summer of 2020 and all that. So it's been exciting to watch. So you guys have different strategies. Can you kind of give just a quick overview of the different strategies you operate at Parify?
Yeah, so we're focused really broadly across the opportunity set of crypto. So we have more directional and non-directional strategies, some with a more quantitative non-directional overlay, and others that are really more focused on just deep bottoms-up fundamental underwriting of tokens. I think one of the interesting things about this space is that tokens have cash flows that can be modeled. And these blockchains are just incredibly data-rich in terms of being able to look at users, volumes, retention rates. And if you can identify interesting trends in on-chain data, you can express views in liquid markets, which is quite different from venture, where you have to kind of build relationships with founders and wait for companies to raise every 12 to 24 months or try to preempt a round, but there's no guarantee you'll be able to enter. So we do a lot in liquid markets. And then we also spend a lot of time in private markets. So we've made over 150 different investments in private companies and pre-launch tokens over the years. We've taken a more stage agnostic approach. So we've been extremely active early stage, but we've also invested in companies like Consensus, where we led the Series D. Consensus owns MetaMask, which is the largest non-custodial wallet in the space. So we really kind of invest more broadly across the ecosystem, and we divide up our strategies and time accordingly.
Makes sense. How big is the team today?
We're about 20 people.
Okay, great. And so you notably built some in-house kind of proprietary products. I think a couple are like Trask and Alexandria, for example. Can you just kind of explain what those are and kind of why you guys have decided to build these out internally versus using third-party tools that exist?
Yeah, so I think the overarching focus really has been, how do we design a repeatable investment process? And I think in asset management firms, investment firms, you want to really focus on the machinery behind them. So how decisions are made, and create repeatable processes. Otherwise, investing can be a bit random. It's more ad hoc judgment calls, which I think is how a lot of funds in this space and just broadly are set up today. So we've designed systems internally to kind of capture data and use data to help us make decisions. One of them is quite simple. We have just a detailed note-taking database called Alexandria. And the idea here is our team is meeting with hundreds of founders every year. I think last year we met with maybe 800 or 900 founders in the crypto space. And so we created a repository of different notes from those conversations. And it's really helpful because if I'm getting on a call with a team building a new decentralized exchange, I can look back on my notes with all the other teams building DEXs that we've met with over the years and kind of compare and contrast notes and what they're building with what competitors are doing. And it just allows our team to really leverage our whole brain and kind of keep that data. A lot of the best investments we've made at Parify are ones where we've known the founder for many years and passed multiple times on rounds and then finally decided to pull the trigger. And so like having that paper trail of notes and conversations and kind of understanding how founders thought about their business a few years ago versus today is really helpful. So that's Alexandria. We've also built out internal tracking tools so we can understand NAV in real time or as close to real time as possible across some of our funds. The space is not as mature as traditional equities where you have prime brokerage products that kind of do this for you and you can like click buttons to buy and sell stocks. Obviously, in this space, the infrastructure is a bit more of a patchwork. You have exchanges, you have OTC desks, you have custodians, you have different validators for proof of stake tokens. You have private investments, you have liquid investments, you have smart contracts that you may have to claim from. It's fairly heterogeneous. And so just tracking and understanding and having a handle around all that data, we haven't been able to find a firm portfolio company that's actually built that out-of-the-box solution for crypto firms yet. So we've had to kind of build it in-house and refine it over the years.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I guess, yeah, when the product doesn't exist, you just need to build it yourself. So you mentioned you guys' focus has been kind of at the intersection of crypto and financial markets. You guys have been very active in DeFi historically. Another category where I have seen you guys be active is kind of around the tokenization real world asset space. I think it was recently announced that ParaFi invests in Securitize. Some of the other folks involved in that round were some pretty big heavyweights, folks like BlackRock and Hamilton Lane. Would love to dig in a little more around tokenization. Maybe you can explain a little of like what it is, just high level, why you guys think it's an interesting category. And curious also what you're seeing kind of larger TradFi players in terms of their interest and activity in that space.
Yeah, definitely. So look, I think historical context is kind of needed here. So if you look back to the ICO boom in 2017, there were these things called STOs, security token offerings, that were taking place alongside them. And the idea here was, let's take an asset in the real world, say it's an apartment building in Queens, and let's tokenize it and kind of fractionalize it and put it on the blockchain. And there were a number of companies that were focused on this, everyone from Harbor, which raised $50 million of venture capital, to T0, to Polymath. And by and large, a lot of those experiments failed, because I think one of the insights was, hey, just because you tokenize something and put it on the blockchain doesn't make it more liquid. You still need demand for those fractional shares. And so many of those firms have ended up folding. But over the years, there's been a lot of traction in this category, and most notably with stablecoins. So stablecoins really are kind of the quintessential tokenized real-world asset. They're tokenized dollars. They're effectively US dollars put in the file format of a token. And stablecoins arguably have more product market fit than anything in crypto, maybe aside from Bitcoin as a non-sovereign store of value. Visa put out this dashboard that shows that just in the trailing 30-day period, there's been roughly $2.5 trillion of stablecoin settlement on chain across 26 million wallets, 350 million total transactions. And stablecoins are being used in everything from B2B payments to international remittance to trade finance. So real organic use cases. So stablecoins, I think, are relevant because if you can put dollars on the blockchain, well, why can't you do that with real estate? Why can't we do that with private credit? Why can't we do that with treasuries or even collectibles like art, high-end watches, whiskey, baseball cards, and so on? And I think this is, in my mind, this idea of kind of tokenizing different real-world assets is one of the biggest, if not the biggest opportunity in crypto. And candidly, I think it's tough to see our industry really scaling unless we solve this problem. So we've been monitoring Securitize for many years. They actually were one of the projects that launched in 2017. So they've been building for 7+ years and slowly figuring out this problem set, like tokenizing real world assets. I think it sounds simple, but there's some smart contract technical challenges. There's obviously this kind of regulatory puzzle that you have to figure out. And then last but not least, you need that institutional trust. And so all of these things have kind of been multi-year problems that we see kind of slowly improving and getting better. That has led us to being very active in this category. We maybe have a dozen or so investments in the RWA sector, and then most recently, Securitize. I think what's interesting about Securitize that makes it stand out from other projects is that they've teamed up with BlackRock, who's the largest asset management firm in the world. BlackRock is tokenizing short-term treasuries through the Securitize platform. They launched that product about 60 days ago and have around $400 million outstanding. And Larry Fink has basically said, hey, we view the tokenization of real-world assets as the next big innovation in capital markets. It's on the same scale as when we move from paper to electronic in the 70s and 80s. So I think there's a lot of reason to kind of be excited here, because that institutional trust component was really missing. And now that BlackRock's involved, I think you're going to start to see much more meaningful growth in this category.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I guess to help folks understand, obviously can't speak for BlackRock, but Why does a company like that want to tokenize treasuries or anything else? Is it just a function of quicker settlement and basically lower operational costs in the back end? Or what's kind of the incentive for them to do that?
Yeah, I think there are a few different advantages of having a tokenized, say, treasury versus just a treasury in the traditional finance realm. So one is atomic settlement. So with assets that are tokenized, the trade is the settlement. So the transfer of the asset is the settlement. So it's T of zero, as opposed to traditional assets that may settle T plus two, or in the private credit world, assets may settle T plus 10 or T plus 20 days. And actually, like in traditional finance, you've seen settlement costs grow 14% at a 14% CAGR over the past decade. And 5 to 10% of trades actually fail each day, like largely driven by human error. We just did a deep dive into this. So there's a huge kind of back office cost takeout settlement component advantage to moving assets on chain. So that's one. The second is being able to hold assets sovereignly. So if you own treasuries, say on Lehman Brothers before it filed for bankruptcy or when it filed for bankruptcy, you were effectively a creditor in that insolvency. And you eventually got your treasuries back in kind a few years later, but you didn't really have access to those assets over a multi-year period. The idea with tokens is you can actually possess that asset and hold it without a brokerage or intermediary kind of sitting in between you and the issuer. And this goes for, I think, will eventually can be said for stocks or for private credit or other instruments. So I think there's that kind of sovereignty, being able to hold it directly without an intermediary. There's also a big component around efficiency. And you've heard Larry Fink talk about this. If you look at a typical private credit or bond deal, there's complexity around getting interest expense paid to end holders of a loan, amortization payments, principal payments, excess cash flow sweeps, and so on. So there's this whole supply chain of payment agents, servicing agents, collateral agents in the syndicated loan markets. And by moving these assets on chain, you kind of eliminate a lot of those intermediaries who all extract some of those interest payments and some of the effectively adds to the cost of capital for borrowers. So there's a big efficiency play here. And by the way, this is one of the big reasons why we've seen asset management firms lean into the tokenization space rather than banks. So if you look at BlackRock or KKR's also tokenizing LP stakes in funds, they view this technology as a big cost-saving advantage, whereas the banks are the ones that generally profit off of owning that capital market supply chain and have historically either been more resistant to this technology, slower to adopt, or have wanted to bring these onto private blockchains that they can monetize. And look, there are a number of other advantages to tokenized assets. One is like you don't need financial audits. You have full transparency into ownership. Arguably, things like Archegos or Silicon Valley Bank or Lehman or Enron, a lot of these historical financial crises were due to lack of that transparency. But if you have assets on chain, you have really complete visibility into ownership. So very long-winded answer, but I'm pretty passionate about this because I previously worked in this world and I just see so many advantages, first principle advantages to tokenizing these assets versus what we have today in the legacy system.
Yeah, and I appreciate the color and all that. Now, I'm going to give you a quick plug as well. Folks, go to parify.com/library. The team has some good content there. And the third one down is called Tokenization, the Future of Financial Markets. And Ben gave a good talk on this category with a little more detail on things. So please head over there if you want to hear a little more about the tokenization space. So within DeFi, you know, as you alluded to earlier, that's kind of been your core for a while now. You guys have been investing in that space as long as anybody. Like, how have you seen the market evolve over the past few years? And within DeFi, are there any like certain parts of DeFi that you guys are particularly excited about or focused on today?
Yeah. So DeFi is kind of now in a phase where I think it's starting to mature a bit more, starting to become more efficient. And I think we'll grow at a steady rate into the future as different issues are solved. I think there are a few challenges facing DeFi right now that need to get solved. to see kind of that next leg of growth. One is, I think a lot of what the kind of core assets on Aave, Compound, Uniswap, these DeFi protocols tend to be more crypto native assets, which again are always going to be around and always going to be a big part of this asset class. But until we can actually solve the moving real world assets on chain, I think the TAM of DeFi will be a bit more limited. So the team, there are a number of teams that are focused on owning that RWA stack within DeFi, and we're excited and focused on investing and finding those teams. The other thing is KYC and regulatory clarity. So the kind of first wave of DeFi was largely kind of permissionless DeFi. So these are smart contracts that kind of anyone could show up to, trade on, regardless of where they were in the world, regardless of who they were. There's no identity component to the space. And I think that that really also needs to change to kind of unlock the next wave of growth. So we're seeing more DeFi projects focus on KYC. We recently invested in a layer two called Kinto, which is basically, in order to bridge assets onto Kinto, you need to go through a full kind of KYC proof of humanity process. And so then as a result, everyone who has assets on Kinto is KYC'd, and DeFi applications can launch on Kinto and have that guarantee that anyone transacting in their protocol has gone through that process. So I think those types of approach to regulation are critical. We also have, there's a bit of like a team incentive problem. I think this is broadly across, not only in DeFi, but just broadly across the crypto space, which is projects launch, founders typically have four-year vesting schedules. And towards the end of those vesting schedules, they kind of look around and try to figure out what they're going to do next. There aren't board of directors to restrike equity packages. So there are no ESOPs or management incentive plans like you have in traditional company building. And so show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcome rings true for me in the space. So really focusing teams on building value long-term as opposed to medium-term, I think is something that has to get solved. And then I think in DeFi right now, we're seeing a lot of creative destruction in certain categories. So there's a borrowing and lending protocol called Morpho that's come along and built a version of Compound or Aave, but with much more targeted kind of risk pools, which we think is really a step forward. So there's, I think, going to continue to be creative destruction and improvement on the margins. And I think there are just those few unlocks that we have to see happen in order to kind of get DeFi to achieve its long-term potential.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And I guess the reason that you would want to have KYC DeFi is because your institutions and regulated parties won't utilize DeFi if they can't be sure who counterparties are, or at least that, you know, let's say, unsavory folks can be guaranteed not to be involved.
That's exactly right. Any institutional party can't engage in a financial transaction really without knowing who your counterparty is. So there's KYC, know your customer, KYB, know your business, and KYT, know your transaction. So these are all like absolutely critical to ensure you're not trading against someone who's on an OFAC terrorist list. And so until we put those guardrails in place, and it can be done through whitelisting, there are a number of different firms that are focused really on that identity problem, which I think is a very critical puzzle piece to getting this regulatory picture right. I think until we get that right, most of DeFi will continue to largely be retail driven, people that just don't necessarily need to focus on those regulations.
Makes sense. Yeah, I'm curious, in terms of different blockchains, you know, one, within the tokenization space, where are you seeing folks like BlackRock or Hamilton Lane or any of these other big asset management firms? Is there a certain blockchain that you're seeing kind of consistency around where those tokenized assets are being settled or which blockchain they're using? And then for Parify, just as a firm, are you guys mostly focused on ETH DeFi or something else? Or are you pretty chain agnostic, or how do you think about that?
Yeah, so I think there are like a few buckets of where we're seeing institutional activity. So there's a big chunk of activity that's happening on private blockchains. So JP Morgan Onyx, what Figure is doing with home equity line of credit on the Provenance blockchain, where they have roughly $7 billion of loans that they've originated on that chain. So the private blockchains are certainly like a big bucket of where you're seeing institutional activity. I think the second bucket is really on EVM layer one as well as layer two chains. So if you kind of drill down into, say, the tokenized treasury market, roughly two-thirds of it is on Ethereum. So this is where, for example, BlackRock's tokenized treasury has been launched. So that's the second bucket. And then the third is kind of a hodgepodge of longer tail layer ones that have been focused on bringing real world assets on chain. The next biggest actually is Stellar, because that's where Franklin Templeton has launched their tokenized treasury product. They have about $350 million outstanding. So we're kind of seeing real world assets happen broadly across different blockchains. I mean, stablecoins are interesting because actually there are more stablecoins that are issued on Tron than there are on Ethereum. And a lot of that stablecoin activity on Tron is taking place in emerging markets. So look, I think we're going to see real world asset tokenization really everywhere across every chain. At ParaFi, we are focused on investing across the full gamut of different blockchains. I think there are network effects on the leading blockchains where if you have tokenized dollars, i.e. stablecoins on one chain, it's logical just from a developer network effect standpoint, infrastructure standpoint, that you'll probably see other real world assets also pop up on those chains. So it's clear, I think, in my mind, that Ethereum and its layer twos will be one of the nexuses of real world assets, but there will certainly be multiple winners.
Got it. Yeah, I think in terms of things that have surprised me, one of them was what you were alluding to with Tron and just the level of stablecoin activity that occurs there, which is quite significant. Although, to be honest, I think I might be more surprised that Franklin Templeton is building out tokenization capabilities on Stellar, only because I haven't heard anything about Stellar for a long time. Do you have any insight in terms of why they're building on top of Stellar? I'd just be curious.
It's interesting because I don't have any particular insight on that, but I do know that as you look at these tokenization projects, I mean, there is a bit of what I call tokenization theater going on in the space where someone will say, hey, we've tokenized real estate or we've tokenized this bond and put it on this blockchain. And that can mean a whole host of different things. I know for a period of time, the Franklin Templeton tokenized treasury product was not transferable on chain. It could be bought through an app and was recorded on Stellar, but you couldn't necessarily take custody of that tokenized treasury and move it on chain outside of the app. So it was more of an accounting system for Franklin Templeton rather than this autonomous or open network for people to move around those tokens. So that I think is like an important distinction. The other thing is, look, a lot of these layer twos, a lot of these layer ones have huge, huge ecosystem funds, and their main focus is attracting developers and people to build and launch products on their chain. So every chain right now really wants stablecoin issuance on their chain. They really want real world asset projects on their chain. Obviously, they want gaming and DPIN and the whole range of different apps, and they have money to incentivize developers and to build there. They have grant programs. And so there is an element of those incentives that do inform where teams choose to build.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I was particularly keen to cover with you is thinking around fundamental investing. And you guys have done a lot in DeFi. The DeFi ecosystem, if you look at any given protocol, I mean, has pretty clear fundamentals. You can see on chain how much revenue or fees a protocol is generating. You could do kind of more traditional financial analysis and modeling around that, making certain assumptions around the future and how value accrues to token holders and so on. Curious, do you think the market today really cares about fundamentals versus, let's just say, narratives and kind of the broader crypto cycle and just things like liquidity and cliffs on some of these tokens that maybe have a lot of capital kind of currently locked up from VCs? And if we look like over the next 5 years, do you think like the importance of fundamentals become more or less prevalent over that time?
Yeah, that's a great question. Look, I think that markets bend towards fundamentals over time, right? Like that's the natural gravity of things, is that higher quality networks, protocols that are actually making money or actually have product market fit should, in theory, and I think in practice, accrue value more so than things that don't. Now, that can like deviate for short periods of time or for even long periods of time in a somewhat unpredictable way. And I think we've seen that in crypto just more recently with things like memes. I think the meme token market in aggregate now is over $50 billion. We've seen this in infrastructure projects that have very little fee accrual, will launch tokens, have very low float, high fully diluted valuations without real fundamentals. And we've seen those tokens actually be very valuable and be strong venture investments. So there are things that kind of buck the trend or buck the fundamentals matter thesis. I think at the end of the day, fundamentals do matter. And you want to find things that people are using and that are accruing value. Now, I do think that if you overly stuff the kind of DCF PE ratio mentality and try to apply it to the space, it doesn't always work. And part of the reason for that is that no one really knows what multiples these networks should trade at. I mean, you may have a decentralized exchange that trades at 8x earnings, and you can look at that and be like, oh, that's cheap. It's trading at 8x earnings. But the reality is that no one knows what discount rate to kind of apply to the terminal value of that cash flow stream, because there's so much uncertainty into the future of crypto. So it really comes into a matter of like, what's the durability of those earnings? It's probably low. Maybe it's not deserving of a high multiple. So there's so much price discovery across the space still that it can make valuing these assets very difficult. I mean, that's part of the reason I like the space. It's challenging. It's new. In Q1, there was something on the order of 5,400 new tokens launched every day on the EVM alone. So there's so many different projects competing for attention. The data can be very confusing to look at, and it takes a lot of time to dissect it. Most of the charts and data on Dune dashboards, we find errors in, or is it tends to go stale pretty quickly unless someone's really focused on maintaining the dashboard. And so it's very challenging in some ways. In many ways, that's an opportunity. But I think that markets will converge to fundamentals over time. And it's just a matter of having the right capital structure, the right kind of liability structure to actually take advantage of that.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Do you think over time, as there are more funds dedicated to liquid tokens and kind of more traditional liquid asset managers may be comfortable also holding more crypto assets, do you think that will drive that further as well, or not so much?
Yeah, I think that touches on like one of the market structure considerations we're seeing today. Like one is like, what are people buying, right? So one is there are venture investors that are investing in tokens before they launch. There are institutions that are buying Bitcoin, but there are very few funds that are actually buying and looking at liquid tokens. So if you add up like the aggregate amount of capital in that third bucket, it's, I think, meaningfully smaller than the first two buckets. So I think there's just a scarcity of capital there that's kind of looking fundamentally at things that are mispriced in liquid markets. And I'm not sure why that is. I think that it's due to change over time, because usually when there is a good opportunity in capital markets, eventually dollars kind of flow to it, but it may take time for that to kind of course correct.
Yeah, and I guess the lack of efficiency brings opportunity in the meantime. But shifting gears a bit, you guys have a venture practice. You make private investments both on the equity and token side. How do you think about differentiating ParaFi? And how do you guys think about winning competitive deals and how you differentiate yourselves and the minds of founders?
Yeah, so I think the crypto venture investing landscape, I don't want to speak in absolutes, but I would say overall, it's just a lot less competitive than traditional venture. Like the number of firms that are leading deals of a certain size is, you can count them on a few hands. And so I think this is not as competitive of a market as certainly it was a few years ago when you had crossover hedge funds, traditional venture capital firm, generalist venture capital firms dabbling in the space. But the way we differentiate ourselves is like, one, we were really like among the earliest movers in DeFi. We have deep knowledge of traditional finance and of crypto. And we have an LP base that I think reflects that. So we've gone really deep in the real world asset stack, in institutional DeFi. So for any team that's building at the intersection of finance and smart contracts, I think we're usually a great fit for them. We also have a really broad portfolio of different companies across the space. Everyone from like the earliest stage companies, seed stage companies, protocols, all the way through to more mature businesses. And so we're able to kind of connect teams up and down the stack. And actually, as part of that, it's because like we, from the earliest days, are actually users of the product. And I think a lot of venture firms in the space haven't actually used a lot of the products they're investing in. And so I think that simple act of like using DeFi and understanding how it works from a user's perspective is very differentiating. The last thing I would say is we try really hard. We hustle, and it sounds really basic, but we do founder surveys and ask them to kind of grade Parify and how helpful we've been relative to other investors on their cap table. And we kind of collate this data and focus on improving it quarter over quarter. So we just try really hard. Like, we really care. We've had a lot of continuity on our investment team, which helps. And we're very long-term kind of focused. So I think those are really the things that we convey to founders if we're looking to kind of invest and win around.
Yeah, that's really cool. I like the founder survey idea where you can have an actual metric or metrics that you can track and work to obviously increase those metrics over time and have that actual benchmark. A lot of folks help portfolio companies and you know, say they do and you kind of talk through it, but having those actual like tangible metrics, I think is really, really cool there. So if you couldn't work in tech or finance or crypto, what would you do for a living?
Well, I originally wanted to become a teacher. I'm not sure I would do that now, but I'm interested in the education space. Like, I'm interested in learning. It's actually one of the reasons I like crypto a lot, is because you end up learning about everything from game theory to cryptography to economics. So you end up kind of tickling a lot of curiosities, but I like the process of learning and helping people learn. So I think it would be building a business in the education space that democratizes that process of learning and kind of helps people understand things that they don't already understand.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah, not the typical answer I get. I like that. Awesome. Well, if folks want to follow Parify or yourself online, where can they find you guys?
Yeah, so I'm one of the few investors in crypto that is not on X or Twitter. Uh-oh. You can follow Parify Capital on Twitter, at Parify Capital. We also have a presence on LinkedIn. And we have our website, so you can check out different podcasts we've been on, different panels we've been on, different research papers we've put out, and you can contact us there to the extent you're a founder building in the space and want to learn more about us.
Wonderful. Well, this is a really fun conversation. I really appreciate you joining us, Ben. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks so much for inviting me. Really great to catch up.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Inside the Hut with your host, Brooke Pollock. You can find this and other episodes on any podcast player or at our website, www.hutcapital.com.